this week on the Inside Flap.
Yeah, but when they came up instead and said, well, I look at this issue through an originalist lens, and what I do is I look at the actual words of the Constitution. People said, oh, okay, well, you look at the words of the Constitution. That makes sense. That's kind of what we want. And that sort of resonated, and it worked, and it allowed almost a Trojan horse to sort of slip through.
He looks like a guy looking to collect a little paycheck as he's also collecting Social Security.
Oh.
Doesn't slow down, doesn't bat an eye, continues to go, I assume we didn't run them over because I didn't feel a bump and the bus didn't stop and they didn't collect our witness statements. But we look at each other like, what just happened?
The Inside Flap is available on demand and every week on iTunes, Spotify, and around the world on theinsideflap.com. What more can we do for you?
Podcasting live from Littleton, Colorado. This is the Inside Flap Podcast. Thank you so much for joining us. My name is Dave Medicus. Welcome to the show. Seated across the snack shack to my right for this Inside Chat edition is Laura Medicus.
Howdy.
Howdy. As we are with you on a very rare, I don't know if we've ever recorded an
intro. I feel like we have, Saturday
morning
sometimes.
Oh, yeah,
yeah.
I guess so, yeah. Well, not this. I mean, it's
barely not that early.
It seems like I swear I might have heard a rooster crowing 5 minutes ago.
It's after eight. It's not that early. It's just dark outside.
Okay. That's true.
Which is unusual.
It does make it seem
Colorado
earlier than it is.
Mountains had their first snow last night.
Oh, momentous occasion.
Usually happens right around your sister's birthday. Which is, I don't know why, but I always remember her birthday, which is the 8th.
That's right, 3 days, yeah.
So we are a little early.
Shout out to Kate Medicus, not a listener of the show.
That's okay.
That's okay.
That's just probably for the best.
Andrew has enough brothers and sisters
probably
who
for
listen.
The best.
Probably, you can strike that probably. Let's just say for the best. We do have a great show for you today, a great guest. As we talk to David Daley, listen, this is election season, people. It is election season. It's time to educate yourselves. I educated myself by reading this book. It is called Anti-Democratic Inside, the Far Right's 50-Year Plot to Control American Elections. David Daley is a former editor-in-chief of Salon.com. He is one of the nation's leading experts on partisan gerrymandering. And a senior fellow at Fair Vote, a nonpartisan champion of election reforms. And we had he's a fun guy to talk to. We had a really enjoyable conversation.
Smarter than we are.
Yeah, he is.
That's not saying much, though.
And we're not really saying a whole
he's
lot.
He's a well-educated, smart guy.
Yes,
yeah.
He is. And we'll have that conversation for you in just a bit. But first, now, I don't know how many of you out there have had a chance to go to a major Power 5 college football game. Laura and I, the last time we went to a big-time college football game was when we were students at Florida State University, graduate students, and we went to the year they won the national championship, which would have been
under Bobby Bowden.
2000. Bobby Bowden was the coach.
Long time ago.
Peter Wirk won the Heisman, and we
football in Florida State.
Man.
It was heady days.
It was big time.
I mean,
time.
It was big time.
It literally did not get any bigger than that.
No.
You know, we heard the Florida State band play the war chant over and over.
Yeah.
You know, 70,000 strong.
It was glitzy.
Yes.
It was like the place to be.
Yes.
Yeah.
Never sat down the entire game.
No reason to.
The entire stadium.
We were champs.
Stood. Yes, we were. Did the tomahawk chop proudly back then.
Back then,
yes. Probably not so much. And I think we actually might have brought that up with Dave as we talked to him.
Yeah.
But anyway, or was that another author went to university?
Don't know.
Doesn't matter. Point is this. We had friends coming in from out of town to join us at the game, and we were very excited because Sylvia is part of the CU marching band, so it was our chance to see her
the Golden Buffaloes.
The Golden Buffalo Marching Band. G, it's quite a mouthful.
It is a mouthful.
I still can't. G, what is it?
GBMB.
GBMB. Golden Buffalo Marching Band. And, you know, they have a great pregame ritual where the band comes out. They march CU up and down the field. They play the songs. And then the actual Ralphie the Buffalo comes out and races up to the 50-yard line, makes a beeline for the trailer, and sprints into the trailer. One of the great traditions in college football. How long Ralphie's been doing it? For over 50 years, I would say.
Yeah, this Ralphie, I think, is on her third year. It's always a female.
Right, I guess originally...
I feel like it might be a she might be a bison.
An American bison, yes.
Yeah.
Which is ironic because we were playing...
The Bisons.
The Bison, North Dakota State. But the first buffalo was named Ralph, and then they figured out it was actually...
A girl.
A girl, and they had to change it to
She's
Ralphie.
She's a girl.
And there have been, I don't know, 7 or 8 since then.
I'm sure.
Ralphie. So we're very excited to go to the game. The game, because it was on national television, it was on a Thursday night...
Oh, the worst time for a game.
Yes.
I've got to tell you.
Listen, the game started at 6 o'clock.
A terrible time on a work day.
Right. But because...
In the Denver Boulder metro area, we have a lot of traffic. I know if you're listening to us in Atlanta, in LA,
DC,
Chicago, we maybe don't have the kind of traffic that, like you do.
Right.
But for a Midwestern... Western mid-sized city.
A lot of traffic. And they're now, because it's on national TV, it's going to start at 6 hour time, which of course is 8 o'clock Eastern time. And we all know where
the money is.
It's in New York, and it's on the Eastern coast where the majority of Americans live.
Really?
And that's what, yes.
Huh.
I believe 51% of the country
lives
in the Eastern,
East Coast?
Eastern Standard
really?
time zone.
Huh.
Yeah, don't
That's
quote
fascinating.
Me on that.
You don't know. You just made that up.
No, I believe that is true.
Oh, okay.
Well, I can look it up, but you know, we can.
We have time we for other things.
Up. Yes, we got a lot to get to. So we decided, or I decided, so two things were going. There were a lot of things in play at the time. I had to pick up our friends from the downtown. First, I had to work. Then I had
work.
To book, you know, there's this pesky little thing called work. I had to pick up my friends, Dave and Oka, from the Brown Palace Hotel. Which had a lovely hotel downtown. Laura, I believe you did a window display for them once.
I did. It was awesome.
Yes, a very historic downtown hotel that's been around for quite some time. I had to pick them up, then drive up to Boulder. We had to figure out the parking situation. Online you can read any on-campus parking is only for donors apparently,
and yes,
so
yes,
if you donate
money
you get to park
absolutely
on campus. If not, if you're a schlub like us, but hello, we're donating a lot of money for Sylvia's tuition, how about a little shout out for us? I guess you got to go above and beyond. We had to figure out where to park, and then you catch a shuttle bus on a camp. So this whole thing was going on, so we literally left,
and this was the first we'd never. Like, you don't know what to expect when you go to one of these things.
Absolutely no idea
also,
what to expect.
Also, I don't know why. I think because we came from a really big football program, Florida State.
Right.
Even though we do have, CU has Deion Sanders, who's a star, superstar.
Yeah.
I still think of Colorado football as kind of like Podunkville.
Right. Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
It's hard to wrap your brain around
the fact that... Because it's not the South.
Yeah.
Like, the South has fantastic football teams.
Yes. And even though...
And we are not in the South. And we don't have big players. Like, we didn't used to anyway.
But we have a star quarterback, a star wide receiver,
true,
and of course, a star head coach.
Absolutely.
Anytime your head coach has got The Rock, Dwayne Johnson on speed dial, you're going to get a lot of attention.
I mean,
and that's
Deion's
why
a star.
Yeah, he is.
Yeah.
So we figured, I figured if we left Denver myself, now Laura, you had your own thing going on. If
I
we
sure
left
did.
At 4 o'clock, that should be plenty of time to make a half hour, ostensibly half hour drive to Boulder and get to the game in time. I picked up Dave and Ilka. We arrived in the city of Boulder around 5. Stop and go, bumper to bumper traffic. Finally got in the parking lot. The first 3 parking lots we were told online to go to were all closed.
Were they full?
Full.
Oh.
Sorry, full.
Wait,
not
how
closed.
Early?
Full.
How early was this?
This was
an hour before.
An hour,
game?
1 hour before kickoff.
Oh,
an hour
okay.
before kickoff.
That's good to know.
First lot closed, second lot closed, and as we're inching closer and closer to the end of the road where the lots were, we got to the last lot. We were told. And had public access, was 85% full. We were one of the last cars to be able to get into this lot.
Oh.
And they had like newbies at the so we got held up
working the gate.
they were trying to figure out, yeah, working the lots, trying to figure out how to get, they wanted to squeeze two more rows into this field.
Oh.
And then there was a guy in a truck who was not happy that he was going to have to like
do a 25 point turn get in there.
Exactly. And so
a lot of people drive trucks. It's again, it's right. Colorado.
So they had to make us be the last line in this field. So there was plenty of room for us to pull out after we had parked. And as I was pulling like two cars down from the Mr. Truck who refused to squeeze in an extra
good
lane,
for you, sir.
The guy who was collecting the money was coming up to him and he literally said to okay, Mr. Truck.
Okay. Yes. He had an attitude?
He did. Okay, Mr. Truck.
Give me a
truck.
Break.
I could not believe it because there was no room to squeeze in an extra line. But the thing is because the field was off kilter and the way they had been parking them was also off kilter. We were at the end, you know, and it was going to slowly.
You were in a truck too.
Up. I was also in a truck. So like we were at the end of the line where it was kind of tight. But because they'd been parking them kind of herky-jerky, by the end, there would have been plenty of room to make two lines. So, you know, you can see what they were thinking. But no, Mr. Truck was having none of it. But anyway, so we got there. And then it took another 20 to 30 minutes to board the shuttle bus. Mm-hmm. And then the shuttle bus ride was this guy.
Oh,
well, first of all, it was stop and go traffic all the way to get over to the stadium.
I'm aware of that.
1 mile to get to the stadium. Stop and go traffic. The guy almost hit someone.
Oh,
the guy, because people
like
person? People a person.
Yeah,
people,
pedestrian heavy.
People are walking to the stadium. Oh. There's scooters everywhere. Dave Ilk and I are in the middle of the bus. We're standing up and we're chatting, but we're also looking ahead because we're frustrated because it's stop and go traffic.
Sure.
You want to see. It always makes it seem fast if you can see.
Yeah.
The lack of progress that you're making.
Worst.
I look up and I see the bus is making a left-hand turn, and I see people crossing the street in front of us coming from the right. The bus is turning to the left. I see ahead through the intersection we're going. People are cutting across the intersection from the right. The bus driver is like looking to his left. People are like kind of hurriedly crossing ahead of him. I don't know if he doesn't see. From my vantage point, it literally looked like because I couldn't see the left-hand side of the bus because I was on the right-hand side of the bus. Mm-hmm. I see the people start to cross.
Oh.
The bus is turning as they're crossing in front of the bus from the right. And then I lose sight of them, but it literally looks so close.
Because they ran over them.
It looks like they were just run over.
Oh, my goodness.
And I see people in like the front of the bus like shouting, oh, whoa, whoa, whoa. They're doing this deal. The bus doesn't slow down.
Wow.
He looks like a guy looking to collect a little paycheck as he's also collecting Social Security.
Oh.
Doesn't slow down. Doesn't bat an eye. Continues to go. I assume we didn't run them over because I didn't feel a bump and the bus didn't stop and they didn't collect our witness statements. But we look at each other like, what just happened? It literally looked like we just ran, and people in the front of the bus are freaking out. Guy is stone cold, stone cold face, keeps driving the bus.
Wow.
It was terrifying. And we got to the stadium in plenty of time to sit in direct sunlight. And we were on the wrong side of the stadium.
It's hot, too.
As the sun, we're on the east side, so the sun is setting in the west directly in our eyes. I had sunglasses and a hat. Dave did not have a hat.
And the other funny thing is it had started to get cold like the week before.
Yeah. Right.
And I had heard you on the phone telling your friend, you know what? It's cold. It's chilly here. It's going to be chilly. Yeah. You're in Colorado. You know, you're going to be in a high elevation. It's going to be chilly.
Right next to the mountains, pal.
And then we had a little heat wave.
Yeah.
Like so we always do in September.
It was like 110
or late
degrees.
August. Yeah. It was very hot.
It was.
Then I get there too, and we're all like, everyone had a beautiful coat of sweat on them. Just
a nice
shiny
sheen. Indeed.
And Dave's like, I heard it could snow later.
He did say that. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
But you had your own little adventure to get to the game.
Yeah. I had a work meeting that afternoon. Again, work. So the earliest I could leave was 3.
Mm-hmm.
In reality, I could have stopped my work at 2:30, but I hadn't. Not really. Anyway, I left at 3.
Again, 3 hours before game time with
without traffic, a
45-minute drive.
To be able to see my girl take the field and do all this. I had to take the puppy to my parents' house because I didn't want to leave him alone for that long at night.
Mm-hmm.
So drove to Golden, dropped the dog off. Then I hit the road between Golden and Boulder, which is a non-divided highway. It's kind of a dangerous road.
Two lanes, Interstate 93.
Two to four lanes.
Usually, mostly two lane.
There's like one couple traffic lights on it. And it was stop and go traffic from Golden all the way in to where I ended up parking.
Right, probably about 20 to 30 miles.
So it took me, over an hour to get what should have taken 25 minutes.
Yeah, and I kept getting text messages from you, stop and go traffic, and then you're trying to figure out, you had a plan on where you were going
to
park.
I had talked to the meeting that I was at earlier, had a former CU graduate, a buff, he was going to the game. He said, oh, no problem. I said, where do you park? Oh, I always park at the high school.
Right.
Always park at the high school.
Yeah.
It's free.
Right.
Nobody's there. Yeah. You don't mind a walk. I don't mind a walk.
No.
He said, it's a half mile walk. He said, it is uphill to the stadium, but it's downhill on the way back.
Downhill on the way back.
No problem. No problem. Sure. I have legs.
Yes.
And then as I'm getting closer and closer, just inching my way, I have nothing else to think about. I'm realizing it's a Thursday. Game days are usually Saturdays for college football, which means high school is not in session.
Right.
It's a Thursday. And so I get to the high school finally, and it's like really hot. The sun is in my eyes. It's stop and go, heavy pedestrian. Boulder is filled with college kids multiple times to me.
Yeah.
College boys who like to pretend they're superheroes, and they love to hold their hands out in a stop motion.
Oh, really?
Yes. And step out into traffic.
Oh, they own
oncoming
the streets.
Oncoming traffic.
They own the streets.
And they flash you what I think they think is a winning smile. But in my mood, it was not a winning smile.
Hey,
and
ladies.
I was not amused.
Hey, ladies. How you doing?
And then they usher them and their friends across the thing.
Oh.
And that happened multiple times. And then, like you said, there's people on scooters. People on scooters don't behave in a way that's rational.
No,
I've found.
And they're going fast. They also think they're above the law, and they
scooters
are.
Scooters should probably be banned.
Superheroes.
They are so dangerous.
They really should be.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So. Yeah.
Man, get
so
off of my lawn.
That's why I was laughing. I felt really, really old. So I try to pull into the high school, and then I realize there's this guy probably was one of his happier days working the high school.
Oh, really?
It probably was a maintenance guy, and he was on a John Deere tractor.
Oh.
And he was sitting at the entrance to the high school, and he was looking so fierce, and he had a big sign next to him that said, unless you're with a high school, don't think about parking
here. Wow.
And he was checking people in, and you could tell this was his day. There is no way he's going to have you tell him that your kid's a senior there.
Yeah.
When you're dressed in white and black, because we all had white and black on for game day.
Yeah, you had it.
Or if you had any type of CU gear on, he's not letting you in that parking lot. And it also was completely full.
It was full?
Completely full. Because I think there's after school activities.
Yeah, I'm sure there's after school activities, but.
He was a fierce looking guy. Wow. Unless some people maybe were able to hide their CU gear.
I would have, even as you were just saying that, I was thinking about, well, I have a teacher ID.
I'm sure some people did try
meet.
That. Yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Of course, it's Denver Public Schools.
So then at this point, also, I realize I'm not going to make it for any of the pregame festivities. I'm not going to get to see Ralphie run. Have not eaten dinner. It's like, whatever.
I had the pulled pork nachos.
Yes.
Delicious.
Yes, he did. And so then I end up finding a parking spot in a warehouse area, and it was a good half hour walk uphill to the stadium.
Well, we were watching and tracking your progress and hoping that you would still make it anyway, but You missed it by like five. I guess
I didn't miss it by much.
You did not miss it by much, and the
I did try to see Ralphie.
The hang up was to get the line at the stadium to get in.
Oh, I forgot. The line to get into the stadium was immense.
Yeah.
It was crazy.
Yeah. Yep, so that's probably the last time we're going to go to a Thursday night game. It was also, we thought the weekend before Labor Day, maybe there was some traffic, but I think it was just
regular. It was all football traffic.
It was all football. There's only two roads, basically, leading into Boulder from Denver.
Boulder is a beautiful city, but the traffic around that football game is...
There's just not a lot of roads there, and you got a lot of traffic coming
in. So now, you know what we should do? If we were wealthy, you would go to the Stampede the night before... You'd get a hotel room, and then you'd enjoy your time in Boulder and go to the game. If we were wealthy. But we are not wealthy.
The Stampede was fantastic. The night before, they have a little, it's almost like a pep rally downtown Boulder.
Really enjoyable.
The whole football team is there.
Dion was there.
They get on little floats. They drive down through the streets of Boulder. It seemed like the whole city of Boulder is there.
Yeah, but not overwhelming. It was a great crowd.
Yeah.
A lot of fun.
That was a lot of fun. But
yeah. The football game, though, like,
game day
if you can do it,
tough.
You spend the night in Boulder, I
think. That's a good point. That's the way to do it.
Yeah, but we won't be doing that.
Not when we're donating, not when we're donors, tuition donors to the school. All right, well, let's get to our guest, Dave Daly's new book out. David Daly, we call him Dave, a couple of Daves here. His new book out is called Anti-Democratic, Inside the Far Right's 50-Year Plot to Control American Elections. Listen, this book is just fascinating. I learned so much reading this book. It is a chilling look at how some of the brightest and sharpest conservative minds in our country got together. Listen, back in the day, as members of Ronald Reagan's Department of Justice, and there was one lawyer in particular, you might have heard his name. This is a guy who would attempt to tear apart, really did tear apart, the Voting Rights Act. That lawyer's name? John Roberts, and we all know where he ended up. This is a sinister look at gerrymandering and how the whims of the minority can end up having majority rule in this country. Just an absolutely riveting read. I urge you to pick up this book, especially in an election year. So important. Such history. This would be a history text in the classroom, for goodness sakes. You know, Silver's taking that history of education class. I mean, they need to read some passages out of this one. Dave Daly does such a great job at looking at how we are now in this country and how it was really part of a long, long process. And he goes into incredible detail how it all went down and continues to go down. So here now talking about his book, Anti-Democratic. This is David Daly.
State on freedom. Oh, there ain't no harm in keeping my mind. Hey, state on freedom.
Really appreciate you taking some time out to talk about your new book, Anti-Democratic. Dave, listen, this is a tale of gerrymandering, Shelby County, and Ronald Reagan's DOJ. Goodness gracious. This book is something. Also, by the way, this is a hell of a cover. This is how you design a cover right there. I don't know who did your cover, but good God,
Gary.
That logo is it hits deep and it hits quick and it's a good one. But anyway, Dave, what inspired you to write this book?
You know, if you care about the state of American democracy right now, you don't have any choice but to care about the courts. And when you start peeling back the layers of the courts, what you see is we're not in the place we're in right now by accident or by coincidence, but because of really long-term, careful, strategic planning that goes back decades, that is meticulous. And, you know, this could have been three books. You start to peel back the layers. And, you know, I mean, I'd written a previous book about gerrymandering as well. And once you start seeing the American political process through the eyes of redistricting, you can't unsee it. You see it everywhere. And it's the same with the courts. And the combination of the two of those things have really tied us up in knots.
Wow. I set a chill on my arm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Not a good chill. Not one of those, ooh, there's a delightful twist in a thriller. No, not one of those shows. It's a spine-tingling, cold dose, hard slap of reality. So let's start with the gerrymandering. How long has this been going on? We know it's been going on for quite some time. What is it all about, and how insidious has it really become?
Boy, I mean, gerrymandering is a problem that dates back to the founding of the nation, right? Oh. I mean, as long as we've had politicians, they've drawn their own districts and they've tried to draw themselves districts in which they can't lose. But this takes a different turn. And I'd say it begins to take a different turn in the redistricting process that happens after the 2010 elections. And what happened there really is that all of those politicians prior to this were drawing these lines with old maps and magic markers and sort of based on guesswork as to where they thought people were. And after 2010, they've got supercomputers and they've got terabytes of data on each one of us. And we're so partisan and polarized that you plug in the car you drive, the magazines you subscribe to, a couple of the things you search for online that your cookies have traced back. And suddenly you've just got an incredibly precise portrait of the American electorate. And that when you draw these lines, you're able to just with perfect clarity determine outcomes for a decade to come. And Republicans sort of stumbled into this, that they kind of figured it out. After the 2008 election in which Obama's elected, it looked like Republicans were going to be on the outs for a while. And so they were just trying to hit on something that would maybe give them a little bit of momentum. And they said, oh, well, we redistrict after years that end in zero. What would happen if we tried to take over the process by winning state legislative seats? I mean, it's Moneyball, really. It's like these seats that nobody ever thinks about.
Right.
But they have this outsized control over the process. And if you live in Wisconsin, if you live in North Carolina or Ohio, Florida, in the last decade, Pennsylvania, Michigan, your democracy was not really your own. Your lawmakers were pretty much insulated from the ballot box, and they behaved that way.
Wow. But they are gaming a system that lets them behave this way. So it is fair, I guess, in terms of how they would see it.
They're exploiting legal loopholes in the system. But the results of this has really been to entrench an anti-small d democratic minority rule across wide swaths of the nation. When you look at what has been baked into the structure of our politics, you've got redistricting that allows people to draw lines that dictate winners and losers and can allow minorities to hold super majorities in office. You've got the U.S. Senate, which by 2035, 70% of us are going to live in 15 states, which means 70% of us will have 30 U.S. senators.
Wow.
You've got the Electoral College, which bakes in a small state a bias in part based on the small state bias that is the U.S. Senate. We've had two presidents this century alone elected with a minority of the popular vote. And those two presidents have appointed five of the six conservative justices on the U.S. Supreme Court, then confirmed by that U.S. Senate that sort of lacks that kind of popular legitimacy. You begin to see, once you look at it, sort of how minority rule is simply baked into what we've come to expect and accept as normal and legal, but it's still deeply problematic and has still stripped a lot of us of our voice and rights in a democracy.
Yeah,
it really has. Yeah.
Recently, I've done a lot of thinking about my sixth grade social studies class, Dave. You know, which is not something I'm usually want to do, but I remember
distinctly learning about the Electoral College, and they would have us do a couple exercises where, all right, who won this year? Blah, blah, blah. Okay, this one. Well, what if, is it possible for someone not to win the popular, and we're all as kids, this is the most ridiculous. Twice it's happened. Oh. Twice. How is this governed by the majority? It just drives me absolutely nuts, Dave. It drives me, gets me so mad.
Whenever you've designed a system that sixth graders look at this and say, this is stupid.
Yes. Something's wrong.
Maybe it just doesn't quite hold up.
Yeah. You know, getting back to the Supreme Court, you open the book with a very interesting quote, courtesy of Chief Justice John Roberts from 2009. Mm. He's talking about the American people, and he says, quote, "They do not elect us. If they do not like what we are doing, it's more or less too bad." And pretty
talk
problematic.
Yeah.
Pretty problematic, chilling. They don't care, is what that tells me. Not that I thought that they did, basically. But I would like to think that
there was someone
in there caring. But it sounds like there's not.
Well, I mean, I twin that quote with Abraham Lincoln from his first inaugural, in which Lincoln writes, "The candid citizen must confess that if the policy of the government upon the vital questions affecting the whole people is to be irrevocably fixed by the decisions of the Supreme Court, the people will have ceased to be their own rulers." And so if you have a Supreme Court, and yes, I understand the role of the Supreme Court was to be a co-equal branch of government in our system of checks and balances, and to be certain that laws passed constitutional muster. There is an appropriate role here for the court to play that is not necessarily outside, right? I mean, you want a court to feel as if it has judicial independence.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What you don't want is for a court to be captured by partisan interests and then to tell you that they're behaving through judicial independence. And we can all see with our own eyes what's happening, right? I mean, it's like Joe Biden at the debate.
Yes.
All of us of good faith could look at this and see with our own eyes what was happening.
Yeah. Absolutely.
We can look at this court and say the same thing. You know, I mean, Neil Gorsuch has a book out, and he was out the other day saying, oh, these ethics guidelines that people want, they would really cramp judicial independence. And I it made my jaw fall open, because Neil Gorsuch holds his stolen seat on the U.S. Supreme Court because plutocrats spent $10 million to hold it open during the 2016 election, then spent another $10 million to ensure that he took the seat in 2017 after Trump won. And then he's handed down reliable decisions after decision in cases involving the administrative state, the regulatory state, guns, to justify their investment. A judicial independence. I mean, it's outrageous.
It is outrageous. That's a great word.
I would love judicial independence. I think we simply define what it is differently.
Yeah, we do.
Just a little bit. I get now. Listen, you've heard me get a little angry. I get so angry. I get, my blood starts boiling. I know, and I'm not a laid back. I'm a theater guy. I'm a laid back guy. But this stuff gets me so angry. How do you disassociate yourself? You've written a couple books about this.
I don't know how you did it.
How do you do it? Please help me. How do you
it's calm a powerless. The powerless
deep breathing
bourbon rosé. No. You're right, though.
I just feel helpless.
Yeah,
it's hard because this is toxic.
Yes,
and when you're tracking Leonard Leo's money and influence, when you're looking at this really concerted effort to capture the courts, it does make your blood boil. Yeah. I mean, it is outrageous. People like to fight about whether we're a republic or a democracy. It's the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, the idea is that the people ought to rule. The consent of the governed is crucial in any representative system. And what is happening is that step by step, consent of the governed is being stripped. Yeah. And it's being stripped by people who have studied the process and found the pressure points that they can step in and control under the radar. Republicans have been better at this than Democrats over the course of the last several decades. And as a result, they hold this sort of outsized control. And you get decisions like the Dobbs decision that, you know, strip reproductive rights that people have counted on for 50, 60 years now. And the court has the chutzpah to rule, oh, we're not taking rights away. We're simply returning a contentious issue to the people and their elected representatives. But as they well know, because they made the rulings in these redistricting cases,
The
people and their elected representatives are two different things in so many states across the country. So they're returning it to a process that's already rigged, that they've allowed to be rigged. And it is, if you start to think about it too much, you know, it's important to pet your dog and go for a run, right?
Exactly. I got to go for a run. I got to. That's the only way I can deal with it.
Get yourself out of that mindset once in a while.
Yeah.
You know, Justice John Roberts, you write about him and his time in Reagan's Department of Justice, and it seemed to be quite the breeding ground for some really hardcore conservative thinking, wasn't it?
Yeah, Reagan's DOJ was almost an intellectual hothouse. It was a think tank almost, in which a lot of these ideas that have bubbled up to the current moment, I wouldn't say they necessarily had their birth there, but they become popularized and they become politicized there. I think Edwin Meese, who was Attorney General under Reagan, understood how this idea of originalism could be used in the political process, how you could take a legal theory and turn it into a political theory. Mm-hmm. Because when their judges came up and said, well, we want to get rid of Roe versus Wade, senators said, we're not going to confirm you and put you on the bench.
Yeah.
But when they came up instead and said, well, I look at this issue through an originalist lens, and what I do is I look at the actual words of the Constitution. People said, oh, okay, well, you look at the words of the Constitution. That makes sense. That's kind of what we want. And that sort of resonated, and it worked, and it allowed almost a Trojan horse to sort of slip through. But you know, it's not just that, right? It's the unitary executive theory. It's the war on the regulatory state. It's voting rights. It's all of these things that they tried to chip away at through the electoral process and failed. I mean, John Roberts' first job in Reagan's DOJ is to work against what Congress was trying to do in reauthorizing the Voting Rights Act of 1982. And even in Reagan's America in 82, you couldn't be against the Voting Rights Act. It was like being against, you know, motherhood and jazz and baseball. It just, you know, it didn't work.
Right.
And Reagan's political people wanted nothing to do with it. And Roberts fought hard, very determined. I've got his emails, his memos. Mm. Well, not his emails. There were no memos. I have his letters and his memos. I did not have his emails in 1982.
No.
The Federalist Society fact checkers are going to come after me.
That's right. Be careful now. They will.
And they lost. And what they realized was, okay, we're trying to force through something that most people don't want. That's hard to do when you don't have the president 51 votes in the Senate or 218 votes in the House. Mm. Most people might look at that and say, oh, well, if this is something most people don't want, maybe we shouldn't do it. We lost. That's not how these guys think.
No.
What they thought instead was, well, what's the alternate way that we could do this? Oh, well, we could get five people on the U.S. Supreme Court. And hey, John Roberts, maybe you could be one of them.
Oh, my gosh. Mm. Well, I mean, what were the Democrats? Were we sleeping?
What's going on? What were we doing?
Party at drinking too much?
That's a great question. You know, I mean, I would say a couple things. I would say that the Democrats definitely fell asleep on redistricting.
Yeah.
And I don't blame them for that so much, in that redistricting had always sort of been there and nobody had thought to use it in this exact way prior to that. They were coasting off the Obama good vibes, yeah, and they thought they were going to have this forever. Republicans said, well, maybe we've got something here that can countermand it. And it worked. I do blame Republicans for, excuse me, I do blame Democrats for falling asleep on a specific op-ed that Karl Rove published in the Wall Street Journal in March of 2010 that said what they were going to do and where they were going to do it and
they
what the
always
were going to
it
be.
Hidden in plain sight.
They always tell you. Yeah. They tell
you. Like, you know, he wasn't hiding it on some blog or his Substack behind a paywall. You know, it was in the nation's largest newspaper.
Oh, man.
And
yeah,
they didn't get it. So, you know, that to me is political ineptitude.
Yeah.
But the courts, I think, is a different story. Republicans controlled the White House. They were able to make these appointments. They used the appointment process with great strategic aplomb.
Yeah.
They founded the Federalist Society so they would never get fooled again when a couple of justices early on in the 80s and 90s were not as conservative as they wanted. So the Federalist Society really becomes the proving ground where they watch people over decades and they prove themselves and their intellectual conservative bona fides, and that they would win, you know, thumbs up or thumbs down based on that for sort of appointment.
Right.
Democrats have always had a sort of romantic belief in the courts. I think it goes back to the Warren Court in the 60s, which was so revolutionary and expansive and protective of rights and freedoms and liberties. And when you grow up with something, you always think it's the best,
that's
right?
That's true.
That
the is
same
true.
Way, yeah. You know, you can't tell me the Smiths and REM aren't the best bands in the world. And you can't tell these 80s, you know, kids who grew up in the 60s idealizing the Warren Court that the Supreme Court has become this anti-democratic bastion. But it has, you know.
It definitely has.
And Morrissey has become kind of a creep. So I think Democrats understand it now. Biden, after in 2020, was not super interested in talking about court reform. Mm-hmm. Now there's a little more interest in ethics and term limits and the like, and that's a good start.
That is a good start. Well,
that's so cool. Yeah.
So ultimately, then, here's the million-dollar question. Do you think the Democratic Party, in particular Kamala Harris and Tim Walz, will they be able to overcome the Electoral College and take the election?
They've got a lot of momentum on their side right now, and things look better for the Democrats today than it looked 2 months ago.
Yes.
But I think in the end, they're going to have to overcome the Electoral College. They're going to have to overcome the impact of state voter suppression laws in gerrymandered states, or in states where the Shelby County decision freed these states to do things that they would not have been allowed to have done a decade ago.
Yeah.
Those states are Arizona and Georgia, the states that were 10,000 votes, 11,000 votes last time. And when you see what's happening in Georgia right now with these county election boards trying to gum up certification, it's easy to see how the goal here, Republicans are playing a game in which most of us think Election Day is November 5th.
Yeah.
And they realize that 5 week period after Election Day, before results have to be certified by states December 11 and the Electoral College meets December 17, that those are the real deadlines, that those are the real election days. And if you can slow it down, if you can push it into the courts, and then if you can push it into their courts,
like the U.S. Supreme Court,
what you could get is another Bush versus Gore, right? And that was the proving ground for this entire theory. And three of the current justices worked on Bush versus Gore on Bush's side.
Oh.
Roberts, Kavanaugh, and Barrett were like young lawyers working on that cases.
Wow.
So if you think that the outcome would be any different than Bush versus Gore,
you'd be crazy.
You know, it's more than 180 million of us are going to vote on November 5th. Then, yeah. I mean, after December 17, it's possible that those nine could be the ones who decide.
Oh, that's so scary. That's so scary. How much damage do you think Trump did to this country?
Trump certainly appointed those three judges. He appointed those justices based on a list that Leonard Leo and the Federalist Society and the Heritage Foundation gave to him. I mean, Trump certainly did a lot of damage to our civic spirit, to our personal spirit, yeah. Right? I mean,
chaos. It was
so many family Thanksgivings.
Yes.
You know, but one of the points that I want to make in this book really clearly is that Trump came along and picked up the pieces of chaos that were created earlier.
Mm-hmm.
The redistricting that baked in so much unfairness and unleashed so many uncompetitive districts that were then won by extremists, that happened in 2010.
Wow.
The Shelby County decision that gutted preclearance of the Voting Rights Act that then allowed those gerrymandered legislatures to do their worst, that's 2013. Mm. The Citizens United decision that the six unlimited plutocrat dark money into our politics, that's 2010. So Trump rides down that escalator in 2015 and bad things happen.
Yeah.
But the groundwork for our real small d democratic crisis was laid before that. He certainly worsened it, accelerated it, but it was sitting there waiting to happen. And I think would have happened under just about any Republican president. I mean, I think Mitt Romney could have been elected in 2017. And it wouldn't have changed what
has happened.
Georgia and Texas and Florida and Arizona did and how this Supreme Court ruled.
Yeah. Wow.
Well,
really quickly, though, just last question. Do you have hope for the country? Do you feel hopeful right now?
You know, I think this is just the latest chapter in a long push and pull.
Yeah.
And so I have hope because I have looked at the last 250 years and there is always a pushback, right?
Yeah.
There is always a fight back.
Yeah.
And this is our moment and this is our fight back.
Yeah.
And it's not easy. But it wasn't easy for John Lewis in the 1960s. It wasn't easy in the 1870s. It wasn't easy in the 1910s. It wasn't easy during World War II. I mean, there is always a fight. And I think that's what we have to understand is that a democracy is a verb. It's not a noun. And we have to keep working at it, right? I mean, Dr. King talked about the moral arc of the universe being long and bending towards justice, but it doesn't bend by itself. It bends when all of us grab it and pull it in the direction we want it to go. There's going to be people pulling it the other way, so our hands better be on that arc and pulling as hard as we can.
Well, Dave, you're doing all the pulling you can with this book, Anti-Democratic, such an illuminating. We didn't even scratch the surface of this book. Such an illuminating read. So good.
Not educated enough.
Yeah. I mean, I thought I knew a little bit going into your book. I knew nothing. And I thank you for that. But Dave, thanks so much for spending
thank
some
you.
Time. You know, don't start drinking that bourbon yet. You got a few more, you know, wait till 5 o'clock or, you know, I guess you're on the West Coast. So,
you know, I'm on the West Coast. It's 3 hours earlier. That means 2 o'clock, guys.
Okay, there you go. Have a great
Thank
day.
You. Have a great
Pleasure.
Day.
Thank
Bye.
You. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, there you go. Thank you so much to Dave Daly for joining us. Check out that book, Anti-Democratic, Inside the Far Right's 50-Year Plot to Control American Elections. I like to read a lot of horror. Or you like horror as well. In real life. Talked about and discussed. All right. Thank you so much for listening. And, see ya.
Adios.
Okay, Mr. Truck.